Well, good day and welcome to another episode here of the Disaster Podcast. I'm your host, Jamie Davis, the Pod Medic, and we are back with another episode here. We're actually picking up with part two of our segment on mountain rescue with James Corbin, and he's coming to us all the way from Benin, Africa, in West Africa. He stayed up late and called in during our normal call-in time on Tuesday night, where we were able to get him on around midnight his time. And we continued to talk and a little bit longer than planned, so we made it into a two-part episode. And in this one, we kind of pick up with some more of his mountain rescue training and some of the things he ran into when he arrived in Africa with some austere medical situations. So let's, without further ado, jump on into this call. Again, we have Dr. Joe Holly on the call, my co-host Sam Bradley, and our weather expert and emergency management expert, Becky DePodwin. So without further ado, here's part two of that episode with James Corbin.
So now for something completely different. You moved to the island nation of Palau in Micronesia for a year. What did you do down there? You're expanding your medical career, obviously.
Right. Well, I was really fortunate to be able to do a little bit of everything. So I had graduated from my PA program. So I was a certified physician assistant. And I moved to a country that actually had some familiarity with physician assistants. Both the Navy and the Air Force send basically can think about the Navy Seabees. The Air Force has a similar program. They're Air Force Simple Engineers, I think they call them, to build roads and schools. But they always send usually a PA with them, sometimes an independent duty corpsman who effectively functions as a PA. So they knew what PAs were. They're very familiar with it. Now, the way we got there, again, I'm very fortunate to be married to a woman who's much smarter and much more talented than I am. And so having finished her clerkships, the island nation of Palau, it's not a territory. They have a longstanding relationship with the United States, but it's a full independent nation. They hire former U.S. law clerks to come and work with their Supreme Court to help with rule of law stuff, to basically do what a law clerk does in the U.S. So I showed up there, and like most places outside of the U.S. and Western Europe, they are short on healthcare providers. So I showed up, and they said, "Holy smokes, can you work?" And I said, "Well, I don't know. Can I? I'm a PA." And so they very quickly gave me a medical license and put me to work. So I did. I got to know there were only two surgeons, not including the OBGYNs, which of course are surgeons as well, but there are only two surgeons in the country. And so I got to know the general surgeon very well. And so he would text me because he had an anesthesiologist and a circulating nurse, but it was just him. He didn't have a first assist. And Dr. Joe will understand there's no laparoscopic anything in Palau. Everything is an open surgery, and so you really need two hands for big open surgery. Sometimes you need four. So he was very happy to have an extra set of hands, and I learned as much surgical procedure from him as I learned almost from anyone. But I would also take call in the emergency department, and Palau only has about 40,000 people in the entire, at least on the main island. So usually it was pretty sleepy, but you know, stuff would come in. But then I would take the states of Palau are separate islands, so each island is its own state in a federal system, almost like, very very close to the U.S. So the Ministry of Health had a boat, and they actually had really nice clinics that had been built by the Seabees and the Air Force, but they didn't have anyone to staff them. And I said, "Well, shoot, I'll go out there." So about once a week, I would take once or twice a week, I would take an outboard boat and go. I mean, people fly for 24 hours. They spend thousands and thousands and thousands of dollars to come and vacation here and, you know, take boats around to see these beautiful. For your listeners, get on your computer or your phone and Google Palau, and you'll see the kind of landscape we're talking about. And so here I was doing it. I was getting paid to do it. It's great. But yeah, I'd go out to these islands. I'd open up the clinic, and very well equipped. They had little pharmacies there. They had plenty of supplies, but they didn't have those people to staff them. So you'd open up the clinic, and sometimes it would seem like half of the island would show up, if for nothing else than the novel, the novelty of the clinic being open. So for a brand new PA, it was a phenomenal experience. Knowing that we were moving to Palau, and knowing Palau is one of the top scuba diving destinations anywhere in the world, I was able to do one of my elective PA rotations at the hyperbaric chamber at UCLA. So I showed up with both an interest and some experience in hyperbarics, hoping just to help out. It turns out that the physician who was in charge of the hyperbaric program was always also the head of internal medicine. He was also head of the emergency department. He was also head of the blood bank. So he very quickly said, "You are now in charge of the hyperbaric chamber." And it was a pretty busy chamber, not because scuba diving is inherently dangerous, but just because Palau is a diving destination. I mean, it's like saying why does Aspen have so many broken legs? Because people come there to ski.
Yeah, good point. Well, there's another show, Jamie. We haven't talked too much about hyperbaric medicine and dive injuries, so make a note of that. What do you think?
Oh, well, it sounds like we're going to have James back on again a couple of times.
At least. What do you think, Joe? He makes me tired just listening to him, all this stuff.
Well, I should put a plug in for my friend who got me involved in the rescue squad in Whedon was working on his pre-med. He was planning on going to medical school. None other than Dr. Doug Swart, who Seth Hawkins knows, I think, fairly well. And he's still in Maryland. He's an emergency medicine physician at, I think he's at Upper Chesapeake. He keeps bouncing around. But he went back and got he got double boarded. He did in hyperbaric medicine. And so he is both he's the medical director for, I think it's MARG, the Maryland Rescue Group, but I'm sure I'm butchering that. But he is also one half of the Maryland Shock Trauma Hyperbaric Chamber, and he was also a rock climbing guide, just like me. We were guides together, so he would be a fantastic source to have on, who would not butcher my 10-year-old hyperbaric medicine at this point, since I haven't done it for a while. So you should think about having Doug on.
Oh, absolutely! Please hook us up. You could talk about the then and the now. Because that's a topic we haven't really jumped into yet. So now, because you were bored with Palau, you went back to Tucson and worked mountain rescue with two teams.
Right. So we finished up our year in Palau. My wife's contract ended there, and we had talked about staying in Palau longer. She had law school debt, and I had PA school debt, and so. We were about to go under, so we had to go back and get real jobs. You have a great time in a place like that, but you don't make a lot of money. So we knew we wanted to come back to the Southwest. We're both East Coast natives, but the West really has a capture on us, and we wound up in Tucson. And so I continued with the Central Arizona Mountain Rescue Association, but also joined the Tucson Mountain Rescue Team, which always vies for number one, two, three, or four is the busiest MRA team in the country. So Tucson is an outdoor paradise, but people get themselves in a lot of trouble in the outdoors. And so this is now Southern Arizona Rescue Association, SARA. So I was on two mountain rescue teams. And SARA, like CAMRA, is responsible for backcountry search rescue, responsible for technical rope rescue, responsible for cave rescue, and responsible for anything in between. Right? I mean, the disciplines that aren't invented until you get the call out and you say, "Oh, geez, we got this now." So.
Good grief. So your real job was working with the U of A Teaching Hospital with the Division of Neurosurgery. So what does a neurosurgical PA do?
Right. So I started with University of Arizona at the large teaching hospital. This is UMC, University Medical Center. And as a PA, I would do a couple things. One of which is first assist in the OR. Obviously, a lot of these surgeries require multiple hands. So working with the surgeons, working with the residents, but most of that was probably anywhere from a quarter to a fifth of my time. But most of the time, I would be so. Dr. Joe knows this. Medicine is the only field we're the folks that are keeping the paging. The people that make pagers alive. We still use pagers in the hospital. And so when you're on call, meaning you're the one responsible for taking calls from the nurses who are on the floor, who take care of patients, from the nurses in the ICU, from the emergency department, from the trauma team. Now, I should say UMC is the only level one trauma center in all of Southern Arizona. Our catchment basin runs basically from halfway between Phoenix and Tucson. And what's crazy, because Phoenix has, I think at this point, 6 level one trauma centers. But once you get to Casa Grande, which is basically the halfway point to Tucson, that's it. UMC is it. So it's basically Casa Grande to the Mexican border. And by the way, all of the border trauma and some of it on the other side, because of longstanding MOUs we have with Mexico, would come to us. All the way to western New Mexico. A good chunk of New Mexico is closer to Tucson than it is to Santa Fe, the other largest trauma center is, and then pretty much to Yuma and the California border. So our trauma catchment area is enormous. I mean, that's basically the size of, so it's effectively having one trauma center for all of Pennsylvania, at least the landmass, if not the population.
Wow. Well, about this time, as if you hadn't done everything else in the world, you went with the CDC to investigate a Lassa fever outbreak. You want to tell us about that?
So we moved the entire family. We have two children, 4 and 7, along with my wife, to Benin, where she's working essentially as a legal attaché, would be the short form. And of course, what do people in medicine do, right? They walk around and find other people in medicine. So I got to know the local physician who runs the embassy clinic. We're based out of the U.S. embassy. We don't live on a compound, but that's where my wife's office is. And I got to know some of the CDC and USAID folks, and about this time there was a big, a fairly large outbreak of Lassa fever. And Lassa fever is a kissing cousin to Ebola. It's less well known, and it's a little less virulent, but it still has somewhere between a 40 to 80% fatality rate. And the CDC folks didn't have a real good sense for what was happening up north. And so the solution to that is just head up and see. And so I said, hey, can I come? And nobody could think of a good reason why I couldn't. And so they said, okay, sure. And of course, for the docs on the trip, they said, well, geez, we'd love to have an extra set of hand in case things go sideways. And so we had been here 2 months, or 2 weeks, and already I was on this trip and got to really see the medical infrastructure of this country in a way that is very unique. I'm extraordinarily glad I was able to take that trip. And the reality of medicine in most of Africa, certainly in this country, is really motivated, kind of going back to where we started. These folks make very little money. They are dealing with almost no resources. They are dealing with a lot of bureaucratic hurdles, but they just make miracles happen because they're just phenomenal clinicians. They do amazing work with very little. And it was really humbling to see what they were doing. Luckily, the Lassa fever kind of petered itself out. And when people think of public health, they think, oh, the disease chasers, they think, Dustin Hoffman and Outbreak. But the reality is a lot of meetings, all in French, I should point out, that it was like a cat watching a
watching a laser pointer, because I had, at this point I had no idea what was going on. But just, you know, are your surveillance programs in place? Do you have the staff to do follow-up? They have to do what's called contact tracing, which is, if this person is sick, they have to go back and figure out every single person that they talk to for basically 2 weeks. And then they have to contact those people once a day for the next, I think the window is for 2 weeks, to make sure that they don't have a fever, they don't have any abdominal pain, they don't have any joint or muscle pain, because all of a sudden that means they're getting sick. And that's the way you stop these epidemics is to catch the people who are getting sick really early before they can infect anyone else. So it was really eye-opening. I'd not done a tremendous amount of public health work, and the organizations was like watching a ballet being choreographed. It was really interesting to be a part of that.
I can imagine. Joe, any thoughts on loss of fever?
I know from my standpoint, while we wait for Joe to find the mute button, I'll just throw in that I would probably have jumped at that opportunity myself. And I'm wondering if Joe feels the same way, just to learn some more and see what was going on.
Oh, I completely agree. And my loss of fever was preventing me from finding the mute button. But that's one of those diseases that in sort of traditional U.S. medicine, we see incredibly rarely. And, you know, the opportunity to get involved with something that allows you to see some of these much more unusual, much more virulent, and potentially scary viruses, much like the Ebola scare in the U.S. several years ago. I absolutely would have jumped at an opportunity to go be involved with something like that.
Oh, yeah. We're winding down here, James, but a couple other questions. I have to hear about the situation where you operated on a patient you rescued.
Yeah, that was one of the really unique things about being able to be a neurosurgery PA at the same trauma center that almost all of our patients who we pulled from the backcountry. And a quick aside to that, about a couple years in, I started keeping a case log. Now, these were mostly neurosurgery patients, so we're talking about spine and head injuries, but of patients that had been mountain rescue patients that we had pulled from the backcountry and then had wound up, we were involved. Now, of course, everything, all of this was HIPAA compliant. I talked to the patients and the families, and they were all happy to be a part of this. But then taking, because I had access to their CAT scans, I had access to their MRIs, I'd had access to their, in many cases, if they went to the operating room, their OR photos, and then ultimately their discharge and disposition. And as Joe and Jamie know, and that's one of the most frustrating things about pre-hospital medicine, and sometimes even ER medicine, is that patients get admitted and, you know, you see them or you take them to the hospital and who knows what happens. So being able to provide that feedback to our team members, and I eventually put together a case report that I presented at a couple conferences, at EITRS and then at MRA, of, you know, here's a case, a series of cases. Here are the scene photos. Here's the call out information. Here's the first CAT scan. Here's, you know, sometimes the intraoperative photos, and then here's how they did, and here's what we can learn from this. Because we don't, in search and rescue and in backcountry medicine, we're really data poor. We don't have a lot of information. This is one of the things that I love about Seth's textbook, is really trying to put some data and some meat to these bones. But I was actually post-call. I'd been in the hospital for about 30 hours, and of course, I finished this before I had children. We had a couple call-outs. One was actually a fallen climber from a very popular area in Tucson, and so we pulled him out, and he had a couple spinal fractures as well as an ankle fracture, but he did not need surgery. And then we had a call for a guy who had fallen and couldn't move, and this was a very popular hiking area in Tucson. It's Seven Falls. It was just getting dusk. It was just starting to get dark. And it was a really strange call out, because where he was not anywhere near any cliffs or anything, but he was the report we got was he was paralyzed. And I know we're short for time, so I'll try and truncate this. But essentially, this guy had tripped on a rock and fallen forward. He had a condition called central cord, which Jamie and Joe are probably familiar with. But it's a congenital narrowing of the spinal canal. So if normally the spinal canal is one of those big Starbucks straws or boba tea straws, his spinal canal was probably the size of a coffee stir. And it took a really minor trauma and a hyperextension of his neck to give him a cervical spinal cord injury. At first, he was completely paralyzed, couldn't move his arms or his legs. He finally got his legs back a little bit, but certainly couldn't walk. And so by the time we got into him, it was pretty evident, at least to me. I mean, I'd been a neurosurgery PA for about 5 years now, exactly what was happening. So we got him into the Stokes litter, and it wasn't a far transport out. He was ended up being taken to a tertiary hospital that's sort of in between where the call was and the main trauma hospital. You know, they did everything they needed to do, got their CAT scan, MRI, realized that, oh, this guy needs to go to the trauma hospital. So by the time I showed up the next morning, he had just arrived. And I actually saw him as a consult, pretty quickly we went back to surgery and did a cervical decompression, take pressure off the spinal cord, that was the only time I ever operated on a patient that I pulled out of the backcountry. I saw plenty of ones that we had taken out, but they ended up not needing surgery. But I still took care of them in the ICU in the main hospital. But that was really – he recognized me too. It was a really sort of shocked. He thought, oh, the search and rescue team is here. And I said, no, actually, we're going to do your surgery.
Yeah, the search and rescue guy is going to do surgery on you because we're short.
Yeah, so that's full service right there.
Oh, that's scary. What do you think of that, Joe?
Well, it's an awesome story for sure.
Yeah, for real. I probably confused the heck out of the poor guy. So any final thoughts, Becky, or questions?
I don't think so. I'm just trying to absorb all of this.
I know. It makes your head hurt, doesn't it? He's still a young guy. He's got a lot of places to go and things to experience. Well, Jamie, I tell you, we got a number of shows to do with this guy because he touched on so many things that we haven't really fleshed out yet. What do you think?
Well, I think it's just been a great kind of overview of some of the different things that James has done in mountain rescue at different places along his journey in healthcare and with his family and his wife's career as well, which has led him to some pretty interesting places along the way. But you know, one of the things I keep hearing is the importance of being cross-trained and having really good high quality training. I think James stressed that and touched on that numerous times. And it brings us back to, you know, really why we do the show, which is to encourage people to educate themselves, to not just learn from us, but find other resources that we can hook them into to do that. And one of course, the best ways to do that is to get in touch with the folks like Joe at Paragon Medical Education Group. Joe, you guys do all kinds of training. I know you don't do necessarily mountain training, but there are certain things with urban search and rescue that are very similar to these types of either confined space cave rescue or things like that that lead you in some similar directions, I'm sure. Joe?
Mute button, Joe.
Yes. Oh, there we go. Yeah, let's mute button. So interestingly enough, we just got some conversations with a potential client about some austere wilderness and mountain rescue stuff. So we may well be more engaged in that than we have been recently. I think the other thing that's quite telling is the dramatic variety and breadth of experience and education that we heard about tonight and how impactful that is in a disaster situation. It's all about pulling from many, many, many different disciplines to be effective and productive in a disaster environment.
And I certainly, you know, we saw that in some of the travels you did, James, where, you know, you were another valuable medical resource in a place without adequate medical resources often. And I think that is certainly what the case of what happens in disaster situations, where you only have so many EMS providers, so many physicians, so many other medical professionals on the team to go around, and parceling those people out is important. Joe, when people look at doing the kind of training that you guys do, one of the most important things they need to do is actually reach out to you and talk to you about what their needs are so that you can customize a system for them. How can they best reach you?
They can reach us through the find us on the web at ParagonMedicalEducationGroup.com or on Facebook at Paragon Medical Group as well. Obviously through the Disaster Podcast or any of our other social network outlets, just look for Paragon Medical Education Group.
Awesome. And thank you, as always, for your continued support of the program. And you're one of the reasons we do this show in a very big way. So thank you. James, you know, I know you're active in our social media, in our Facebook group, so people can reach out to you there. Is there any other way you prefer folks to catch up with you, or is that really the best way to touch base with you if they have any questions on this episode?
Well, certainly I'm active on Facebook. You can find me at Wilderness PA, also through Instagram at the same handle. And I have an email, mountain.rescue.pa@gmail. But really the social media channels are probably the easiest way to get in touch. So find me. One of the great things about the advent of social media is talking to folks who are doing slightly different stuff, whether it's combat medicine, whether it's operational medicine, whether it's industrial confined space, but that really touches on the corners of what you're doing, and you can just get a tremendous amount from these folks. And it's really as you say, it's a great way to continue the conversation.
Excellent. Well, we'll look forward to connecting folks with you, at least in our Facebook group, if not some of the other places you mentioned. Becky, where can folks catch up with you if they want to kind of bounce a weather question off somebody?
Well, I'm always happy to talk about the weather in the Disaster Podcast Facebook group. Had a few conversations back and forth there, but I'm mainly found on Twitter at WX_Becks. That's BECKS. Or you can search Becky D. Podwin. I'm the only one out there, and I'd love to talk about the weather or emergency management or anything.
Awesome. And we appreciate you being available. We don't want to call you our backup weather person because we think you're part of the team. So we're just happy that you're available. Kyle's going to be on and off shift frequently now with his job, and so we'll hopefully be able to connect with you more frequently now.
Yeah, thanks for having me, guys. I always enjoy it.
Sam, where can folks find you?
Well, the usual social media places that are the aforementioned social media places under Sam Bradley or Sam Bradley 11, certainly in the Facebook group. It'd be really interesting to see the comments on this show and on the disasterpodcast.com. And I have one more comment for James. You were talking about writing a book. The answer is yes. Do it. He was talking about a book just on dive medicine. Dude, you could write a book about your entire life, and it would be fascinating. So where do we find you, Jamie?
Well, you can find me under the handle PodMedic in most social media locations out there, and I want to hear from you, so please friend, follow, or otherwise connect with me there. And, of course, always on disasterpodcast.com or over in our Facebook group. Just search for Disaster Podcast on Facebook and request to join the group. We'll let you in, and you can join I think we're up to almost 650 people over there now, so please come and join the conversation as we post episodes and other interesting things. I'm sure probably tomorrow sometime I'll post some sort of update about what's going on with Tropical Storm or maybe Hurricane Gordon, and we'll see what's going on there. And keep our eye on the more active things going on in the Eastern Atlantic as things come across over the coming weeks. So please check back frequently. You know, Sam, we've heard a lot about just austere medicine, disaster medicine, mountain rescue medicine, but we come back to the same things about, you know, how bringing a multitude of skill sets together is what you need to do to make this kind of medicine work.
What I love about James is his interest in learning new things, like the whole CDC. That was an experience he hadn't had yet, believe it or not. So, you know, that's what helps us learn, is grab any experience you can. And remember, austere medicine is not everyday medicine.